It is Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a new theater company for and by young adults prepares to make its debut in Northwest Arkansas. Plus, our history doctor Bill Smith stops by to examine the history of swing states. Also, we have the latest installment of Arkansongs, Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor, and more. But first, individuals seeking a GED, a general education diploma, have always enrolled and tested for free in Arkansas, one of the last states to offer it at no cost. But by 2014, the program will be privatized and digitized, plus students will be charged a hefty fee. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich visited a Washington County GED center in the old Jefferson Elementary School in South Fayetteville and has this report.
High school diplomas are considered a key to prime employment opportunities, but the lack of a diploma also carries a certain stigma. That's why more than 15 million Americans, one in every seven, have chosen to pursue a GED credential. To help them prepare, GED classes are offered through all sorts of places, public libraries, local colleges, and adult education centers, like this one in Fayetteville.
Yes. So
now I don't think I got none of these right over here.
Well,
more than 1,600 teens and adults passed through the Washington County adult education system last year in pursuit of their GED, ESL, or citizenship credential. Of those, 246 obtained a GED. They range in age from 16 to 44, of varying ethnicities and skill sets, but all are after one thing.
My name's Shane Carlock. I'm already a certified heavy equipment operator. I graduated from NTI a couple years ago. It's really just a personal goal. After this, I'm probably going to go to college.
My name is Rachel Bowen. I'm a single parent mother. I have an autistic son, and he's full functioning in a normal classroom, doing very, very well. The last 8 years has been basically him and me, giving him therapy and everything, and now I'm working on myself, coming to class, getting my GED.
My name is Lourdes Crawford. I'm a seamstress. I was working hard to learn some more so I can, if I go back to work, I can have an easy job.
My name is Milton Solis, and I come to school here. I've been here for over a year now. And it's a wonderful place to come and learn. It's a great experience. You got great teachers. There's great people that want to help you if you want to come and learn. It's free right now, so I would like people to come and try it and give it a chance.
Free for now, but by this time next year, all students will be expected to pay a hefty fee. Kathleen Spigarelli is Director of Adult and Community Education.
Yes, I keep saying we have a tsunami coming. Because it may cost at least $120 just to take the GED test. And that is coming January 1, 2014.
In March of 2011, the GED Testing Service, a program of the not-for-profit American Council on Education, announced a merger with Pearson VUE, that's Virtual University Enterprises, the world's largest for-profit education and testing company based in Britain. And Pearson is currently overhauling the entire American GED system.
It will be all computer-based. There will be no paper-pencil test. It's going to be people needing to know how to drag and drop, how to use the calculator on the computer, how to compose at the computer to do those short answer questions. So this is all coming in 2014.
Every GED testing center, including this one, will have to become a licensee of Pearson. Previously, states subsidized such programming, some for a nominal fee, others for free. The GED testing will also be divided. One is geared towards high school equivalency and job readiness, and the other is college prep. Now, if all of this is sounding familiar, that's because the new GED will align with the new education curriculum being deployed nationwide called Common Core. It aims to align diverse state curricula into one shared curriculum that will better meet 21st century career and college-ready needs.
So we have a busy 2013, added to the fact that we really need to get people in now, and especially if you're someone that is not going to be able to afford $120, you need to come in now and start working towards passing that battery of tests that we have right now for free.
The Arkansas Department of Career Education operates the state's GED program, and it reports that last count of nearly 8,800 tested, 7,500 met the requirements for their GED credential, an 85% pass rate. Nearly 10% of all working-age Arkansans do not have a high school diploma. 24,000 live in Washington County. And to show us just how it works, Kathleen Spigarelli takes us on a brief tour of the Adult Education Center, which for decades served the community as Jefferson Elementary School.
This is the computer lab.
Spigarelli opens the door to a room jammed with students learning computer-assisted instruction. They also teach basic computer literacy, resume writing courses, job search, and the new wage program.
Yes, yeah, students can earn certificates based on certain criteria, and part of the wage program is that we have business partners who then recognize those certificates when they go to hire people.
So clerical, industrial, bank teller, customer service.
Mm-hmm. So these, you know, we're all about not only, people think of us as the GD people, but we actually work a lot in, we serve people in workforce readiness and economic development. It's wonderful. I think the community really likes having us here. We try to be a good community partner, and a lot of people come in to us just for general information that doesn't even have anything to do with adult ed. And when the school was empty, you would have broken windows. In fact, the school district start boarding up windows because they just couldn't afford to keep replacing them. And since we've moved in, no broken windows. So I think that means everybody's really happy that we're here.
School gyms used for material storage. Students can relax or study in the former cafeteria, supplied with donated magazines and newspapers. By the way, they can use more. And upstairs on the third floor is testing and intake.
Because you've got, of course, paperwork to fill out.
This is your intake, okay.
This is intake. And we do diagnostic testing. Your first day. And then they go to orientation and they get assigned to a teacher. And then they start class with their teacher. And then after they've attended for a while, I'm out of breath. They're tested again because, as I tell them at orientation, if you're going to come to class, we like to think we do you some good. So we like to see an improvement on that post-test. And so for people working on GED, what they're working towards is passing a practice GED test. Because for right now, while the test is free, everybody in the state of Arkansas has to pass a practice GED test to take the real test. Because it's expensive to administer and score, and so the state would like to know that there's a real good reason why you're taking this test. So that's kind of the quick process. We also do intake for English as a second language students up here also. And they take a different diagnostic test for placement. Anyway, well, we'll go back to my office.
Because some students arrive with low self-esteem or are discouraged, staff help each individual to start fresh. Many form friendships in the classroom, Spigarelli says. Finding strength in numbers. Pursuing a GED is not for the timid.
You have to remember, if you dropped out of school in eighth grade, you're trying to cram 4 years of high school into coming to class here, you know, maybe three mornings a week. So, you know, it's a process.
And many of the adult students have families and jobs to manage. That's why Kathleen Spigarelli says the program's open entry, open exit.
We have new people who start every day, but we have people who finish every day. And our average hour per student here, and that's a really, it's probably a crazy number, but we're right around 60 hours. Because you have some people who walk in and they're ready to take the test in 2 weeks. You have some people who need to be here a couple of years. You have people that their work changes, they start out, they have great intentions, and then they're gone for 6 months. And then they come back and pick up.
But with the new Pearson VUE system, hard start in 2014, everyone will have to start from scratch.
So 2013, if you are someone who has not completed the battery of tests that is currently in existence, or if you failed part of it and you're You need to retake some of it. You need to get in 2013, because in 2014, everything you've done will be erased, and you'll have to start all over.
In the meantime, Kathleen Spigarelli and her colleagues are looking to foundations and the Arkansas State Legislature to help the state allocate $1.8 million to assist the nearly 8,000 mostly working poor individuals attain their GED certificate so they may pursue either new careers or college. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is my partner in history, Dr. Bill Smith. How are you?
I am great.
2012, of course, had a presidential election, and it's over, of course, except for, you know, the complaining that always happens in a post-election. But the complaining about the American presidential system is far from done. There were a handful of contested states. We now, of course, call them the swing states. They were the object of both parties' attention. Big attention. You recall the other 40 states barely
millions
existed.
Of dollars yeah. of attention.
If you were not from a swing state, you did not see the ad. Both parties, the president, Governor Mitt Romney, put money and time, especially in Ohio, to win the key states. Now, I'm looking to you, Bill, Dr. Bill, to give us the perspective on swing states.
Well, you know, there was much gnashing of teeth mm-hmm. and wringing of hands of this horrible precedent that has been set in which America's fate is only going to be decided by a handful of voters. How dare we have a system like this?
Okay, I'm guilty of having said that to friends. Like, boy, if you weren't from Ohio, Florida, or a handful of other states, so I'm about to find out that I should be chastised, I believe.
Well, not so much chastised as understand this is just the way it works.
Okay.
Swing states are as old as America, and three or four of them have figured in almost every contested presidential election. See if they sound familiar.
Okay.
Ohio.
Sure.
Pennsylvania.
Yes.
New York.
Yes.
20th century California.
Yes. Okay, let's break this down. When you say contested elections.
Correct. I'm not talking about Richard Nixon, 1972, Ronald Reagan, 1984, FDR's three re-elections, the early 19th century, any of the great landslides. This stuff doesn't matter.
Right. We're talking the closer ones.
We're considering elections that were somewhat even, or at least perceived to be even, and there were somewhat of battles.
Okay. Now, in that list of states you just gave me, two have a lot of electoral votes, but have really been put solidly in the blue camp for some time now. California and New York, they were off the table early the last few rounds.
That is correct. But this is why looking back at the old elections is interesting. Once New York and California became the huge population centers and the electoral prizes, they actually moved back and forth between the Democrats and the Republicans throughout most of the 20th century. It's not until Bill Clinton in 92 and then in 96 that you see this phenomenon of those two states being off the table and in the blue column. Same thing with Texas. It went back and forth once it became an electoral prize until roughly the Bushes, when it solidly went over into the red column.
The thing about Texas and California being a swing state, when that happened, the amount of money you'd have to put, because they're so geographically big, they'd have so many large cities, that'd be a fiscal nightmare, I would think.
It would be.
Yeah. Now, Ohio.
Yes. Now, the political line that no GOP candidate makes it to the White House is somewhat relevant. Call it the once and forever swing state, though, right alongside Pennsylvania.
But for all the talk in 2012, the race wasn't as close a call in many of those battle states.
No. And that can often be the case.
Oh, really? Okay, but what about the complaint? Red states, blue states, the Electoral College system allows candidates to only pay attention to those states. And if you're in Arkansas or Montana, you get no attention.
Yeah, because you remember how much Grover Cleveland campaigned in Arkansas.
No.
No, he focused on one state, New York, when he won election in 1880s. You know, that's just in these early presidential battles were over one or two states. That's just the way it rolled.
So that's nothing new.
No. In pre-Civil War contested elections, the big four were Ohio, New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They would move back and forth, tended to settle the outcomes, while the rest of the country pretty much went their own ways, except in the times when there were landslides. One of my favorite graphics that I like to use in a survey class, and especially this year, talks about the post-Reconstruction elections from 1872 to 1892. Guess what?
What?
16 states voted Republican in almost every election. 18 states voted Democrat in almost every election. And by the way, that looked a whole lot like the old Confederacy when you saw the footprint of those Democratic states. That left, you guessed it, four states, only four states, that voted irregularly. In other words, they swung back and forth. New York, California, Nevada, and Indiana during that period.
So has it been geographic this whole time?
Pretty much. In the 20th century, the population shifts would make new states like California join the mix that originally was, you know, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and Virginia. Virginia kind of fades away. California and Texas sort of step in. This current pattern of New York and California going Democrat and Texas to the GOP is kind of a recent development.
Okay, well, recent, like how recent? Are there some examples? When did California last go to the GOP?
Well, let's talk about that because you've got some really interesting maps in some of these races.
And again, we're throwing out the landslides.
We're throwing out the landslides. Look at 1976. It's one of the really fascinating ones. You've got Gerald Ford, who takes California, usually Republican for most of the 20th century, by the way, and almost the entire western half of the country. If you drew a line on the western border of Arkansas, Louisiana, sort of that Midwestern line, everything west pretty much exclusively went to the Republicans, and everything east pretty much exclusively went to Jimmy Carter. Carter gets New York with 41, Pennsylvania with 27, and Ohio with 25. He gets Texas with 26, and that ends up being the pivot. Ford had 240 with California, but you take any two of Carter's swing states, give them to Ford, election's different.
One of the differences being in 1976, you didn't have a Nate Silver and all these interesting web apps that you could just easily, what if this state flips this way?
Exactly. Kind of like 1948. You certainly didn't have it then. And we all know how much fun that one was for the media.
Oh, yeah.
Truman, the Democrat, puts Ohio with the West. Truman carries California in that election, while Dewey and the GOP takes New York and Pennsylvania and toward the East. Now, what also hurt Dewey was the Dixiecrats walking away with 39 votes that might have gone. But you see, even the map there has now flipped East and West back around. 1992, though, is when we begin to see what we see this of a pattern day, the bi-coastal elections.
Washington, Oregon, California blue, New York, New Hampshire usually. So you've got them on the coast, you got the blue, and in the middle you got the red.
Correct. Clinton is going to get New York with 33, Pennsylvania with 23, Ohio with 21, and California for 54 to begin that pattern. But of course, it gets disrupted in 2000, 2004 with Bush. And to me, this is the one I like to come back to when people say, it's only about a handful of states. Yeah, absolutely. When it's 271 for Bush and, you know, you got that one margin.
Right.
Oh, Bush gets Ohio, 21, so there's your swing. He had Texas, Florida in the swing. Gore gets New York. Gore gets Pennsylvania. Gore gets Illinois. But, you know, Florida and the Hanging Chads really aren't the issue. If Gore gets his home state.
Gets Tennessee.
If Gore gets Arkansas, where his president is from, you know, you've got the tip. So it always comes down to a handful of states. It usually moves around a little bit. But again, that big three, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, California, they're not permanently in either category, even though they certainly appear to be today.
The one that sticks out that seems like it's never been able to be taken for granted is Ohio.
That's
right.
I mean,
go back to the 19th century and Ohio was a battleground state.
Ohio has been a constant in American politics. It kind of replaces Virginia, which in the colonial and the early Federalist period was sort of the pivot state. You know, if you played in Virginia, it was like playing in Peoria, they would say. Well, now it's Ohio and has remained to be Ohio to this day.
You may not know this, but in the earlier ones, you know, because now there was discussion like, boy, both parties were concentrating on this one suburb in Cuyahoga County that could flip Ohio, which could flip. Back in the mid-20th century, could they get that specific?
Well, let's just go back to one of my favorite elections where you had Blaine and Cleveland. And Blaine has one fundraiser with one speaker that blows up one part of New York City, and by a little more than 1,000 votes, which, you know, that's pretty much one mistake right before election in a key city in the key state. Grover Cleveland wins New York, wins the presidency because of, you know, 1,300 votes.
Wow. And really, you could even argue half of that, right?
Correct.
Because if it was 1,200 that he lost, if he could have just gotten half of those.
And again, that's back in the 1880s. So once again, targeting down to small areas. You know, we have computers today and we have lovely touchscreen graphics and, you know, Minority Report waving your hands on TV to make it exciting. But in the end, it is one of the great constants of American political battles.
I have a feeling we'll be able to have this same conversation in 4 years.
I think we can have it every 4 years.
But until the Electoral College decides to join the SEC,
we're history.
Good evening, Athena. Is there any truth to the rumors of your birth?
Yes, Tom, it's true. I sprang out of my father's head fully grown, dressed in armor. I guess that's why I'm his favorite.
Talk about a Caesarian!
Actually, Caesar is Roman, I'm Greek.
Local theater is typically pretty quiet in the month of January, but on January 10th, New Threshold Theater will present its debut production, The Iliad, The Odyssey, and All Greek Mythology in 99 minutes or less. Late one evening in December, the cast and crew were rehearsing inside the Be Unlimited Theater in Fayetteville. Three of the cinder block walls in the room are painted royal blue, while the east wall is decorated with painted-on names. Five actors were running their lines, while two crew members sat in fold-out camp chairs. This may sound like a typical rehearsal situation, but what is different about this new theater company is all of the participants are still in high school. 16-year-old Coleman Clark, a sophomore at Fayetteville High School, is the founder and artistic director of New Threshold Theater. Reed Carson and Jacob Benson, both 16 years old, are also artistic directors with the company. Coleman was inspired to create this young adult theater company after learning of a similar one in another part of the country.
A friend of mine, who is an adult professional performer and writer and creator, came to me and was telling me a story about a 16-year-old artistic director of a theater in Florida, I think is what she was saying. And she was trying to kind of plant a seed inside of my brain to kind of get the juices working, to let me know that this is something that Fayetteville should have, because there's plenty of opportunities for kids to act in shows in Fayetteville, and we really love that because we've grown a lot. That's how we met each other, and we've grown as actors through that. But then at the same time, there's not a place in Fayetteville where young adults can almost entirely create a performance by themselves. So like we were saying earlier, we're all artistic directors, which you're not going to find in Arkansas or very many theaters probably in the U.S. have 16-year-old artistic directors. And we have all youth designers and actors and directors. So that's what really intrigued us, was the idea of us having to learn all different aspects of theater rather than just the aspects that we could get in other youth theaters.
The mission of New Threshold Theater is to engage youth performers and audience members in the power of theater performances in intimate settings. The fledgling company launched a Kickstarter campaign in late November to raise the $1,000 needed to help fund its first performance. The goal was met in early December, and New Threshold Theater will debut its performance of The Iliad, The Odyssey, and All Greek Mythology in 99 minutes or less, January 10th. The cast of this comedy is composed of five actors playing approximately 100 different characters using more than 200 props.
Okay, well, good luck with that, finding that special someone.
Plant your feet. Let's try that blackout again. So come in, and we'll just have you go right under where the helmet was, and just give that weird look to the audience, and then exit. So just stay here. Okay? Go right before the blackout, EJ, with your left.
In addition to being one of the actors in the play, Coleman has also taken on the role of director.
Me being the founder of the show, I decided to take on the first show as far as directing, because that's probably where I'd like my career to lead and my college education. So I decided that I wanted to direct the first one, but this one is just so fun. and just so silly that there was no way that these guys and myself were going to let me not be in it too, which is a very different experience because we're still in high school, so we don't have a master's in directing or anything. Directing is hard by itself, but then being in the show is a completely different thing because, you know, normally a director's job is to know everything, is to try to know everything about the show. But with this, I have to try to know all about my one character, but then also a touch of everyone else's so I can help lead them in the correct directions too.
Artistic director Jacob Benson says oftentimes young thespians are only exposed to acting. But New Threshold Theater will allow young adults to have a more well-rounded experience of the world of theater by allowing them the opportunity to participate in various aspects of the process, whether it's acting or behind-the-scenes work. Fellow cast member and artistic director Reed Carson says they are not concerned about having to switch from being on stage and receiving direction to being the ones leading an entire theater company.
I think if we weren't okay with that, then we wouldn't have done the company in the first place. It's, I know we've, Coleman and I have done another show where Coleman directed it, and it was fun, worked out fine, and I don't know, it works out.
Yeah,
I think we're kind of excited for the hard work, though. I think that's what made us drawn to it, is that it's not going to be easy, and the challenge is kind of what we're looking for.
We've had tons of community support, too, that has been we are so grateful for, because really we wouldn't have done this, and this wouldn't have been in our heads at all if it wasn't for community members. So it's really helping having adults around us that are supporting us and really thinking that adults that really think that we can do well. So that helps so that We don't bog ourselves down too hard about it. But I think it's going to be a great show.
Some of those supportive adults will continue to help the new company by participating on a board.
We're getting an adult advisory board set up. We've had a few interested members, and we're still trying to set that up right now. But that will consist of just mostly theater theater people, I guess, that are adults that have worked professionally so that we can get their opinion on things like the shows that we do and ticket pricing and locations. And we're hoping to send out an email to them every month or every 2 months, just asking for their advice on several things that we're doing to kind of see what they would do because they have a lot of education and knowledge that we don't.
There are still things to work out with the company, but looking ahead, Coleman says he expects the company to produce 2 shows this year. Another aspect to consider is who may participate in productions. While the company is for young adults, Coleman says there are no strict guidelines for how old someone can be to participate.
That's not something that we've really talked about. And the reason being is that I feel like we will feel a certain point when somebody is too old. We don't want to set a strict limit because there's 18-year-olds in high school, and I'll be 18 in 2 years, and me and Reed will still be in high school, so we're technically still youth. And I think this is something that we'd like to get even college students involved in because we really like the idea of this almost like 12 to 24 kind of age range or something like that, where it's kind of young adults rather than youth or professionals, that kind of middle ground where it's different.
Yeah, like that's what we mean by threshold. You're not a child anymore. You're stepping into this professional outlook of theater.
New Threshold Theater will present The Iliad, The Odyssey, and all of Greek mythology in 99 minutes or less, January 10th through 12th at the B Unlimited Theater in Fayetteville. Tickets are $10 per person or $7 for students. More information is available at newthresholdtheater.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkin Songs.
You go
Ozark Mountain Daredevils helped craft the country roots rock sound of the 1970s, and the Springfield, Missouri-based group was created around the sound of an Arkansaser from the flat delta land of the southeast. John Dillon of Stuttgart was the only original member of the Ozark Mountain Daredevils who was playing professionally, and that was at a Springfield pizza parlor which drew students from Southwest Missouri State University. Dillon, who played guitar, mandolin, and dulcimer, showed local poet Steve Cash, another future daredevil, how to play harmonica. The Arkansas Countian said he taught Cash harmonica the same way his own mother had taught him, telling him to carry the instrument with him always. Oh, country girl. John Dillon also organized a weekly jam at a local theater when his friend Larry Lee, who played guitar, piano, and drums, became bartender. Other area musicians like pianist Buddy Brayfield, guitarist Randall Chowning, and bassist Michael Soup Granda, who sometimes wore a Superman costume, all learned each other's songs, but the future Ozark Mountain Daredevils reportedly didn't even consider themselves an actual band. The owner of the theater where the musicians played thought otherwise. He worked to get a live tape of the group to music impresario John Hammond, who financed a demo. A staff producer for A&M Records and Glenn Johns, who had produced the debut of the Eagles, both flew to Missouri to hear the musicians in concert, but under pressure, the band faltered in performance. Afterwards, the producers were convinced to hear a post-gig acoustic performance, and the down-home version of Standing on the Rock by Stuttgart's John Dillon sealed the deal with a major label. A year and a half after first playing together, the musicians, which surely thought of themselves as a real band by now, were recording their debut in London, England. The band's debut album, The Ozark Mountain Daredevils, reflected the group's new name, shortened from Cosmic Corncob and His Amazing Ozark Mountain Daredevils. The band found chart success quickly. If You Want to Get to Heaven, heard here and written by Arkansaser Dillon and Missourian Steve Cash, hit the top 25 in 1974. It remains a rock radio staple. But the biggest hit for the Ozark Mountain Daredevils came from their second album, It'll Shine When It Shines, named for another Dillon Cash composition. Although the album was recorded back home in Missouri, the album's true hit was a departure from the band's rootsy sound. Jackie Blue hit number three in early 1975 with a falsetto vocal and a modern pop sheen. Although the group was reluctant to leave Springfield, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils began to tour the world, and with some of the biggest names of the 1970s, Chicago, the Doobie Brothers, the Eagles, and others. The Ozark Mountain Daredevils continued performing and releasing albums through the 1970s. Dillon's Keep On Churning, heard here, is from the Daredevils' 1975 album, The Car Over the Lake. In 1977, theater owner Steve Canaday, who had cajoled John Hammond into hearing live tapes of the band in the first place, joined the group as the original lineup shifted. In 1978, Dillon and Cash appeared on a concept album about the American Civil War called White Mansions, with Waylon Jennings, Eric Clapton, and others. Skin trains, running all day. Skin trains, running all day. In 1980, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils switched to the label CBS for one unsuccessful album, and the group began to peter out and focus on solo projects. In the late 1980s, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils began performing and recording again and found an audience demand overseas. In 2000, A&M Records released a 21-track best of called Time Warp. In 2002, the band's long out-of-print catalog began to be reissued, with its third and fourth albums being released on CD. The Ozark Mountain Daredevils have never matched their early successes, but the nucleus of the original band, Missourian Steve Cash and Mike Granda, and Arkansaser John Dillon, remain together into the 21st century. Here in its entirety is the title track from the 1974 second album from the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, It'll Shine When It Shines, co-written by Stuttgart, Arkansas's John Dillon. The old cat on the roof, he could
could stand a little push. Cause he's got 9 good lives to live. But like my mama said, you only live till you're dead. And you got to give and give and give. There's a pebble in the pond going on and on, making waves and tides and ripples and rings. There's a leaf in the wind that don't know where to end, chasing days and ways and wishes and dreams. Seems like everyone is out looking for the sun, singing rain and pain on he who hesitates. But it'll shine when it shines. You might think I'm wasting time, but I'm just a good old boy that's learned. Whippoorwill's in the dome. Pretty soon he'll be gone. And he's got one good song to sing. But like my daddy said, it's in your heart, not your head. And you got to sing and sing and sing. There's a window in the wall, looking out on it all, leaving fears and tears and troubles alone. There's a fire in the stove, keeping out the cold, warming wine and winters and babies at home. Seems like everyone is out looking for the sun, singing rain and pain on he who hesitates. But it'll shine when it shines. You might think I'm wasting time, but I'm just a good old yes, I'm just a good old boy that's learned to wait.
It'll Shine When It Shines from the 1974 second album by the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, co-written by Stuttgart, Arkansas's John Dillon. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Slime molds are not plants or animals, but they share the characteristics of both. And while they are found all over the world, they remain mostly a mystery to scientists. They come in all shapes and sizes, ranging from yellow-tinted blobs to pinkish spheres. Laura Walker, a graduate student at the University of Arkansas, is working towards a doctoral degree in the Department of Biological Sciences. She has identified 6 species never before recorded in Panama for her research project. This past summer, Laura became the first scientist to collect slime molds from soils in Panama's Barro Colorado Nature Monument. In doing so, she became one of the first researchers to systematically take samples of slime molds, the most abundant predators of soil bacteria and fungi in tropical soils. Last month, Laura stopped by the studio to talk to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about her research with slime molds.
I learned about them in a botany class, and they're not plants, so that's already kind of funny. But
there aren't many protus.
It's true.
Classes to be taken.
It's true. In undergraduate, yeah, here, well, they yes. learn about them pretty early on because there's so many people studying them. But so I learned about them in botany, and I just thought they were so beautiful and interesting, and so I just became like a side interest of mine. And then I was working in molecular biology, completely separate from ecology, from slime molds, and I started working on my master's degree at Washington University, and I did an independent study one semester on mixed mycetes, and nobody knows anything about them there. They, sure, whatever, you know.
And mixed mycetes are a kind of
slime mold. That's the kind of slime mold that I study. And so I did a little experiment in my kitchen with a microscope that I acquired, and just learned a lot about them, and then I thought I wanted to do a PhD program, and I had owned one of Dr. Stevenson's books.
And we should point out Dr. Stevenson here at the university has this beautiful book of slime mold photographs.
Yes, yes. He's very well known. He's great. And so I contacted him and thought, well, maybe it's worth a shot. And he emailed me right back and said, send me your CV. And I was so honored.
It's a tight-knit group, those of you who research, study, and... Mm-hmm. And exchange information.
Yeah, so here at the university we have, I'd say, somewhere around maybe five people that are really interested in mixed mycetes or slime molds. But in the U.S., I mean, that's a large portion of us.
Really?
I don't actually know the numbers. I'd say worldwide there's under 100 people that are really really studying them.
Okay, I want to go back to this experiment you did in your kitchen.
Sure.
You just kind of threw that out there. You did an experiment in your kitchen with a microscope. So you would grow?
So, yeah, I would grow everything. We have this technique where we can just pick up. So they're anywhere where plants are.
If we were to walk out down to the trail here.
We could definitely just pick up a handful of leaves off the forest, off the floor, and put them in a Petri dish, get them wet, and then wait for eventually they'll grow. And so we just monitor these plates under the microscope and wait for them to appear, the fruiting bodies. And so that's what I did in my kitchen.
It doesn't sound that bad.
Yeah, that's how I learned all about them, mostly.
We suspect they have a pretty important role.
Exactly.
In what's happening.
Mm-hmm. So they eat bacteria and fungi, which, as you know, are the main decomposers of plant material around the world. And as they eat those other organisms, then they're recycling the nutrients back into the forest ecosystem. And so, and recently we found out that slime molds are one of the, probably the most abundant of these predators in the soil that are eating bacteria and fungi. And so they have a really big role in the nutrient cycling that takes place in the forest ecosystem.
You have been studying some... You're the first, perhaps, or are the first, to see some of these slime molds in the soil where you saw them.
In Panama, yes.
Yeah.
So there's been a little bit of work done with the soil myxomycetes in temperate regions, but really none in the tropics. And as with most organisms, we expect that they're going to be more diverse and more abundant in the tropics. And so this is the first time anyone's done any work in the soil in the tropics, which is pretty exciting because we have ideas of what we're going to find, but we really don't know. And so my work this summer in Panama, there's only been a handful of surveys done there ever. And so far I'm up to about 50 species probably, and six of them have never been reported in Panama, although they have been reported in other areas. They're not new species. But I'm sure there's going to be lots more.
How hard is it to distinguish species if you're already in a microscope? So is it a simple task to say this is one and not the other?
Well, for Dr. Stevenson, it's a pretty simple task. But I'm still learning. It's sometimes a matter of just a little bit of a color difference or shape, size. There's lots of different features we use to distinguish between species, but it's still pretty challenging.
So what is a typical day of research you look in the microscope? You make notations?
Yes, I do a lot of microscope work. So because we have these cultures going, and to find the myxomycetes, we have to look under the microscope. So every day I have these plates that I put under the microscope and just survey and look for fruiting bodies. And then when I find them, I pull them out and put them in little boxes so we can save them as specimens. And actually, the university here has the largest collection in America.
Are they hardy creatures?
Yes. Yeah. So once they're in their spore, in the fruiting body, the spores are viable for years and years, decades. So they're in a resting stage.
Okay.
So in that way, they can survive for decades. Yeah.
Have you thought that perhaps through your research, your field studies, you might come across a previously undiscovered species?
Yeah, I hope so. I think it'd be really cool.
Now, with that doesn't come the responsibility or the honor of naming?
Yes.
Have you thought about that?
I have thought about it. I think every scientist thinks about it. I wonder. I don't know. It is, Dr. Stevenson has discovered probably 60, more than 60. I have no idea, but it's also a chore. It's a challenge and a chore because you have to, if you're the first one to discover it, you have a big responsibility of characterizing it properly and doing really nice descriptions. And so it would be a lot of work, but I don't know what I would name it.
You have to go to the Latin?
Yes.
That's a rule.
It would require a Latin binomial, yeah.
You couldn't call it like the Ozark blind.
No, but wow. I could translate it to Latin.
Oh, okay. Now, here's the question. And I don't know if this is a fair question. And if it isn't, I apologize. But why? Why should I, the layperson, care that you and your colleagues are doing this research?
That's a really good question. And, I think it's just the same as with any organism. They're vital players in the ecosystem, in the world. And so we need to know what's going on. Oftentimes people overlook all these single-celled organisms, but really that's where everything's at, and that's what's really running things, I think. And without these microbes, things would be much, much different.
Laura Walker is a graduate student at the University of Arkansas working towards a doctoral degree in the Department of Biological Sciences. Last month, she stopped by the studio to talk to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about her research with slime molds. To watch a video about slime mold research at the U of A, go to ozarksatlarge.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 2nd of January, 2013. It's the birthday of Roger Miller, born Fort Worth, Texas, 1936. We know him best for his song, King of the Road, Trailers for Sale or Rent, Rooms to Let, 50 Cents. Though he said his favorite of all his songs was You Can't Roller Skate in a Buffalo Herd. It's the birthday of Christopher Durang, born Montclair, New Jersey, 1949, raised Roman Catholic, went to a high school taught by monks, thought he might become a monk himself, but instead he became a playwright. And when he was 28, he had his first big hit with the play Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You, which the New York Times described as a satire about a demonic nun. He went on to write Beyond Therapy, Baby with the Bathwater, and currently on Broadway, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. Today's the birthday of cartoonist Linda Barry, born in Richland Center, Wisconsin, 1956. She's the creator of Ernie Pook's Comique, a weekly strip that ran in alternative papers for nearly 30 years. Her friend Matt Groening was the man who created The Simpsons, but the market for Linda Barry's comics sort of dried up in 2008, so she moved on to other things. And now she goes around the country giving workshops called Writing the Unthinkable for people, she says, bartenders, janitors, office workers, anyone who's given up on being a writer but still wonders what it might be like to write. Here's a poem for today by Jacqueline Berger, The Conductor. There's no mention, of course, in the program that the conductor has Parkinson's. He enters the stage, stands for a moment facing the audience, his hands by his sides, tapping air. Then he holds them together, an act of gratitude. We're gathered, we can do this, and of firmness, each hand forcing the other to be still. His expression, darkly bemused, the good news, bad news. I've lived long enough to lose so much, or maybe he's staving off our sympathy. Don't clap because of this. Then he turns his back to us, begins his work, Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony. No baton, and from behind, his body is jerky as a boy's, jumpy with excitement. His hands shake when they scoop the sections of the orchestra, as though pulling a weighted net from the sea. Still, I wonder if this work is easier than taking on the ordinary objects of a day, buttons, keys, and pens. I am an old man, he must think, when he looks in the mirror, briefly naked, before trading the bathrobe for the tie and tails. And when he turns to us again, after the last movement, he looks both old and young, his face washed of the expression in the program photograph, clearly taken years before, one eyebrow slightly raised, his smile more satisfied than happy. Now he shows us his innocence, if innocence is what the face, unconstructed, can be called. What else can he do while his fingers tap their useless code, while the audience in rows rises from their seats, still clapping? What can he do but show us who he is, a man standing too close to the edge, edge no one can call him back from. The Conductor, a poem by Jacqueline Berger from The Gift That Arrives Broken, published by Autumn House Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KUAF is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. The Sugar Creek chapter of the Ozark Society will present a program on interesting place names of the Ozarks. Susan Young, director at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale, will spin a little Ozark folklore relating how the names that appear as name places in the Ozarks came into existence. From Accident to Zinc, Place Names of the Ozarks will be presented Monday, January 14th at 6 p.m. Also, an outing is scheduled for January 19th to explore Indian Creek near Gateway. For more information, contact Joseph Meyer at 925-2290. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Blackjack Corner, which is located just to the west of Pea Ridge in Benton County. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great rest of the day, and I hope that your new year, 2013, is off to a fantastic start.